Good evening, everyone. Apologies for the delay if you were waiting to connect. Some technical issues, apparently. Also, excuse me, I once again have a cold, so I may pause to blow my nose. It's that season. As DT Suzuki says, something like freedom and the end of suffering or something like that is not the absence of illness. It's the presence of well-being. And well-being, in his definition, is, like a dropping of the ego attachment to an idea of self, letting go of greed, the three poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance, of grasping, attaining, accomplishing, of wanting things to be what they are not, So for him, well-being is just letting things be as they are. So then that makes sense that it's not the absence of illness, because illness is what is. And we actually suffer a lot more when we try to make it stop and not be ill than when we just allow ourselves to be ill. Of course, it doesn't mean that we don't treat ourselves, we don't rest, we don't avoid contaminating others. We're aware of it, we pay attention to it, but we're not trying to not be that. Something like that. DT Suzuki is full of little gems like that. He was one of the first people to bring these Zen teachings to a Western audience in a way that could be understood. And even today, although he, it was like in the 30s, 40s, 50s that he was doing this. Incredibly, like almost a century ago, some of it still really speaks to us today, in phrases like that, of not the absence of illness, but the presence of well-being. That's really, really speaks and resonates, and speaks deeply to our time, of the, I read today, of course, everyone's very happy about a potential ceasefire in Gaza and the release of the hostages and finally the end in sight, right? And so both of, there's a lot of stuff written about it, and both the Biden and his administration and Trump and his administration are basically Trump. Are claiming responsibility for arriving at this ceasefire. And there's some truth to that matter, that for various reasons, both they actually worked together, the Biden's people and Trump's people worked together to bring about this ceasefire, although it was basically the plan that Biden had proposed in May. It's basically the same thing, but they just have come to, time has gone on and probably some other compromises have been made. I don't know, but for some reason now, we know partly why, but it is happening. If it happens, still not clear because the Israeli parliament hasn't voted it yet. But, and I read that Trump, the article, someone who follows Trump for years and years, even before he was a presidential candidate, and I've said that there's basically two reasons why Trump was pushing for this peace deal, for this ceasefire. One was so that he would have one less problem when he takes office on Monday. Very self-serving, right? He basically doesn't give a shit about, all the people that are being hurt by this, but he just wants one less thing he has to deal with. And the other was because it enhances his image of himself as a deal maker. He's basically constructed his identity on the art of the deal, as his book is, So it's self-serving for him, this peace deal. We're not surprised by this at all, because well-being is not present in this. For him, well-being is material, it's power, it's money, it's image. It's not what does DT Suzuki is talking about in our Zen world, which is dropping of those things, dropping of ego attachment, dropping to an identity of self, dropping greed. Trump is basically just all about greed, whether it's for power, money, image, women, men, whatever it is. So we can see that Suzuki's statements, like this, are absolutely inform our time and have for thousands of years. We can say basically for like 2,000 years or more, the West, well, maybe not 2,000 years, the West, but in our Western scheme of life and existence, we believe that the final problem, the final answer to our problems, will be found in thought, and in intellectual solutions or scientific solutions, or material solutions, so power, money, eternal youth, which is impossible. No, abs no, the absence of illness, old age and death, basically. That's the Western thought process. Whereas, in the Zen, we always point to the experiential. So an insight into one's true nature is what the point is. And that insight is not a thought bound. It's not intellectual. It's experiential. If we have an experience of who we truly are and who the others truly are, and the oneness of all things, all beings and things, then we would not work for a ceasefire in a war to enhance our image and to clear our plate of having one less problem. That would not be our motivation. Our motivation would be to put an end to the suffering, to the killing, to the violence. So we see it's very different, the motivations. And then the results that arise from those motivations will be very different as well. The other current event that we probably will see in full blown activity this weekend and on Monday is, what we call the tech bros, or in France they call it the broligarchy. So this is like, Musk, Zuckerberg, Bezos, these super rich bros. In French we say les mecs, men. These guys who are like super guys. And so they're basically involved with buying power and popularity. And they're all kind of, from one perspective, they're all kind of losers, I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that in the way that they're not like lovable type people that people admire because of their their goodness or they're inspiring because of their human qualities. They attract popularity and attention because they're of their way of accumulating materialistic objects and things and buying power with that. They've bought their way into the halls of power, into the White House. And they're getting ready this weekend to celebrate Trump and themselves. And so again, we will see in full blown what happens when the true nature of self is not realized, and the oneness of self and other, and the true nature of well-being, which is not accumulating, which is not buying. I saw a thing on, one of these apps that I happen to be on a mailing list of, like supposed Buddhist enlightenment apps or something. And there was some teacher who was going to give a lesson on mindful materialism. Thought, wow, that's like a super oxymoron, mindful materialism. What could that possibly be? I don't know. Maybe I should listen to it to see. But the thing is, you have to pay in order to listen to it. And I really don't want to pay to hear about mindful materialism. I suppose if we look at that, mindfulness is a practice or a technique that keeps us from being distracted. So that's the point of it. It's to like not be distracted by all the exterior stuff that's going on, just to pay attention to just this right here. So I don't know if mindful materialism means like, so pay, really paying attention to what you're accumulating. I don't know really what that could mean. But it's intriguing to see how our, here we go, the West, the way that it, French we say accaparé, appropriates these, would have these practices and these terminologies and these notions that have deep experiential meaning and turns them into thought and ideas and concepts. And then we're left with mindful materialism. I suppose why not? I don't know because I don't know what it is. So maybe I shouldn't be questioning it. Sorry, I have to find something to blow my nose with. Sorry. But if we truly see, that we are that we are this, that we are you, that I am you and you are me, and I am the flower, and I am the moon, and I am the cat, and I am Zuckerberg and Musk and Trump, I truly can see that, then that changes everything. In order to be able to see that, though, I have to let go. I have to drop my ideas about Trump and Zuckerberg, self, the cat, the flower, the moon. I have to drop my ideas about it. I have to, we say sometimes, make myself empty. But making myself empty just allows me to be open to receive, to then because there's space there then. We have koans about this, Joshu telling the monk to wash his bowls. Of course, yes, you eat your meal, then you wash your bowl. But it's actually about, emptying yourself so that you can receive. Because if you have a full bowl, well, you can't receive anything. I once had a dream when I was a very young practitioner, many, many moons ago, in which, or I don't know if it was a dream or if it was something that when I was in Daisan with my teacher, who at the time was sensei, but I had this image of myself as being this empty vessel, this empty like container, round glass container. And like she was pouring something, she was this other container, and what was in her was pouring into me. It was like this, translucent liquid or something. And at the time, I didn't really pay much attention to it. And I told my teacher that, and she said, "Oh, you should pay attention to that." The thing about that image was that the container was empty. So in order to receive what she was offering, I had to be empty to receive it. And actually, then I came to realize that she wasn't really giving me anything. I already was that. But this was a long process of years and many moons of practice. And so, this raises the question, okay, well, so if we're not all of that, what are we? If we're not all these identities and all this stuff that we think we are, well, then what are we? And that's a great place to be, because then you can open up to whatever it is. There's a story of from ancient, the golden age of Zen in ancient China, of a guy who went on to be a great master, Obaku, who at the time was just a young monk. And at the monastery where he was fairly newly arrived at the monastery. And the abbot of the monastery was giving the governor of the province who was visiting the monastery, he was giving a tour of the monastery. And there was a room in which there were portraits of various people. And one of them, the governor said, "Who is that?" And the abbot said, "That's the old abbot." Or that's an ancient abbot or something. And so the governor said, "Oh, so this is his portrait, but where is the person?" And the abbot couldn't answer. And so there were some monks around, and he brought them, and like senior monks, and asked them, and they couldn't answer either question. "This is his portrait, but where is the person?" And so the abbot was kind of at a loss, and then he remembered this kind of weird monk who spent most of his time outside garden in the garden, and it was Obaku. And so he said, "Maybe I'll get him in here. Maybe he can say something." So he brought him in and explained the situation, and the governor asked his question again. Here is his portrait. Where is the person?" And Obaku said, "Oh, governor." And the governor said, "Yes, venerable sir." And Obaku said, "Where is he?" So in this exchange, I don't know if you hear what's happening here, if you feel it, but he is the abbot. He is the ancient abbot. Obaku is the venerable sir, the governor is. They all are. He's here and now. He's not some, great person from the past they have to venerate, and is not here now. Of course, it's a different manifestation now. But if we truly let go, if we truly see the oneness and what our true nature is, then we are that. We are the abbot. We are the monk. We are Obaku. So right now I'm telling you this story. I'm Obaku. I'm the abbot. I'm the governor. If we truly see into the true nature of our being, the essence of our being, there's no separation. That's what awakening is waking up to the oneness of life. And then We can truly be creative. We can truly be the artist of our own life. We can see the world just as it is. So the world just as it is, the bros and the oligarchy taking shape in America, the ceasefire in Gaza, the suffering in Sudan, the noise, the people in my kitchen, one person in my kitchen, the people walking by in the street, all of us here on our screens, the people who aren't on the screen. I forgot where I read this. Oh, in a novel that I'm reading, or it's kind of a memoir, but this woman says that when she was a child, she was walking in the streets with her mother one day, and she asked her mother, if you had not, if my papa, if my dad was not my dad, if you had someone else, if you had married someone else, who would I be? What would I be like, or something like that. And her mother said, well, if I had married someone else, you would be someone else. You wouldn't be you. From a Zen point of view, we would say, well, you would just be another manifestation of it, but you would not be this manifestation. And actually, from a Zen point of view, it could not have been other than it is. If one little, flap of a butterfly's wing were different, we would not be sitting here right now. We are all, this moment is, as we say, contingent and codependent on everything else. So it's all here as it is, everywhere throughout space and time. So everything karmically, as we say in Buddhist jargon, has brought us to this moment of the bro oligarchy and the mindful materialism. DT Suzuki bringing these teachings to the Western world and making it accessible has led to mindful materialism. It's also led to many other things. He did this, he wrote this great book with Eric Fromm and another guy about psychoanalysis and Zen Buddhism. And it was like in 1960 or something. And drawing how the two are similar, also where they diverge, but how they are similar. And that has then informed Zen Buddhism, and it's informed psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. So the fact that I'm sitting here with a cold, you're not going to be contaminated because we're not in the same room and we're not breathing the same air. But I got this cold because somebody else had it. And I probably have given it to somebody else. I don't know. And I see other people blowing their nose on the screen. So clearly it's going around in some form or another. And that's the beauty. That's the beauty of our world. When we fail to acknowledge that, though, that interconnection, then we, find ourselves in these situations of climate change because we haven't paid attention to what the consequences of our actions are. Or maybe we have, but we're not recognizing it and feeling any responsibility for it. Another really good Suzuki thing is he said something like, I think it's Suzuki. The attitude, right, the attitude of the past, from a Zen perspective, the attitude of the past is one of gratitude. So we're grateful what has come before, grateful for what has come before. And the attitude towards the presence is one of service. Like Bernie Glassman used to say to us, you can see the depths of someone's awakening by how they serve others. He didn't say, like how much they serve, but it was how they serve others. And our attitude towards the future is one of responsibility. So, how can we, what does that mean? How can we be grateful what has come before? So, can we be grateful for, don't know, somebody told me today, or what was it? Oh, I remember it was my teacher who was telling me that she was actually grateful for, maybe it was someone who was sick. I don't know. Somebody who had cancer, maybe, and was grateful for that because of how it had led them to be awakened in their life. And my teacher had told me that she was grateful for a moment many years ago when she had kind of a break with her teacher. And but she was grateful for how much it had forged her and brought her to own her own way. And her own power and her own path, so those are examples how we can be grateful. Those are negative things, but we can be grateful for, maybe our parents for having helped us learn to walk, or grateful for the person who delivered the food to the market where I or grew the food for them that I bought at the market. Something like that. And then an attitude of present into the present of service. So then, because I'm grateful for what was done before, then I serve others. I serve the moment in a different way because I'm acknowledging what came before and what I'm grateful for. And therefore, I'm serving in the same way that I'm grateful for having been served. And I can even recognize that maybe I'm not even aware of serving. But if I come to it with this informed by this gratitude and the responsibility that I'm taking for the present, then I'm serving the present and I'm serving the future. So if I have responsibility, I would say, okay, yeah, maybe, my husband has this almost 30-year-old car that like can't drive in Paris anymore because of the pollution. Things, well, maybe we should just give it up, for it with an act of responsibility for the climate, for the environment, instead of grasping to, oh, we need to have this car and it's, served us so well and we don't, it's cheap. We don't have to invest in a new one. Well, we don't really need a car anyway, but in Paris. Can we act, serve the moment with a notion of responsibility for the future, for future generations? Actually, most of what happens, though, in our lives is we're not really, we're aware that there are future generations, but we're not really paying that much attention to it. Now that I have a grandchild, I may be paying a little more attention to it, but, thinking beyond my own kids was not really part of my sphere of awareness, In any case, time, I should really stop talking. If we just come back to this, the essence of our Zen practice is seeing into the nature of one's being. That brings well-being. Seeing into one's being brings well-being. And then we don't know, we no longer attach to the absence of things. We have everything. The universe provides. We are great artists of our own lives because we have everything we need. Nothing is outside us. So I will stop there and see if you have things to add or questions to ask. Questions are always good. And thank you for listening and being present here.
Can I say something?
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead, Miguel.
Hello, everyone. The thing is that one thing is acknowledging the, as you said, the oneness and the non-separation. And of course, that brings us well-being. But then there is the this human being, and its very rooted habits, and some of them not very healthy. And it seems that that is one of the major problems in maintaining this well-being, not seeing well enough the particularities of this of my own human being, let's say. Not that I or we can see that we are each thing, everyone, but then there is to integrate it in the everyday life and in this particular human being with its own karmic I don't know. I'm just thinking. I'm sorry. It's acknowledgement of this human being is it continues on and on and on. It seems endless. Of course, maybe it's not, but at some point, yeah, okay, it's empty of the possibility of getting out of well-being, as you said. But well, just calling the attention to this how this human being and its laws and connected to everyone in everything. It's very demanding to clear it in the sense of being completely full with it. Okay, so I'm not going to continue. Thank you. I'm not sure if you understood what I'm.
Yeah, I think so. And I imagine that others can understand parts of what you said too, because it's kind of our human predicament. So a couple of things. This human is not endless. It's limited. It's part of the limited relative world. It's a manifestation of that, of the limited, you know, particular world. And it's all of the emotions and the thoughts and the psychology and whatever you're saying, you know, I think that's what you're referring to, or the habits that, you know, arise from those things, or our habit of attachment to all of that, is also limited, because that's part of the limited self. And our problem fundamentally is that the limited self thinks that it is the master and the boss. And we believe that that's who we truly are, and that that's how things are. And then we become, you know, desperate because there's no way out and we can't stop these patterns and all of this. Now, when we awaken to the other aspect of our being, which is limitless, which is endless, which is not, you know, submitted to the constraints of the relative world, which is does not have a fixed identity, that then allows us to have a different view. You know, it gives us a new view of all the limited stuff, that our patterns and habits. It's not, doesn't mean that they're all solved, as you well know, Miguel. I mean, you know, it doesn't mean that it's all gone. And I think you're saying that. It's like, okay, it's still there. Which is where, okay, so let's go back to mindfulness. That's where mindfulness is a good technique to, you know, it helps us to not be distracted. It helps us to see things, to see these, you know, patterns. And awareness of the pattern is already a step towards becoming free from it. It's like shining the light on something that, as soon as it's not in the dark anymore, well, it doesn't have the same power. And then when we can look deeper into it, we can see its empty nature, meaning that it's like a cloud. I think we talked about this last week, that it doesn't have any substance. Or someone, I guess it was Krisha who said it's just a belief last week. It's just a belief. So when we can see that, then it the power that the you know, the we're no longer in its clutches in the same way. Little by little, the more we do it and we look at it and we sit with it and we allow things to arise and fall, then we gain some space and some freedom from it. Of course, it's tenacious, because we've been conditioned for all these years to function in that way. And, you know, like, so, you know, if we go to the extremes of Donald Trump and Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and these guys who are like the extreme examples, you know, they're caught in the thralls of it. But, you know, as the Dalai Lama said about Mao, even they have their nature too is awakened. They just don't see it. They too have the same Buddha nature, the same, they are, we are one with them in terms of our basic nature and essence. They too have the potential to wake up and realize it. However, the more we accumulate and the more we attach to this stuff, the more difficult it becomes to let go, which is why mindful materialism seems like it would be problematic, because you're becoming mindful of stuff, but you're still accumulating it. So yes, true. Everything you say is true. I just, you know, point out, because I listened to when you say it's endless, it's not endless. and it is limited. It's part of this limited life we have.
I know. I was speaking about the karmic and the interconnection of everything that it's,
That's
and
true. Yeah. And our actions, of course, have consequences. That's why, in Tashin, we chant in the morning the verse of atonement. We recognize that we can't even see all the consequences of the stuff we've done. Some stuff we can clearly see the consequences, and some stuff we don't really want to see because it's bad, or we think it's bad, or we're shamed. Or we're full of shame, or we realize, oh, I shouldn't have done that, or maybe not even that I shouldn't have done that, but oh, I caused harm with it, because that's what we talk about, all the suffering that I've created. And so seeing it as already the first step, then we have the possibility of atoning for it. And when we've seen it and we realize the harm we've done, then we have a better chance of not doing it again. But it's true, we can't control the consequences, the karmic reverberations. The only thing we can do is we can only act in this moment, with in the present moment, what was it, service, with a responsibility to then what the consequences will be. And maybe even be grateful for this stuff that we did that was not so great. And because it's brought us to where we are today. When I was in high school and I applied for the university I really wanted to go to, the college I really wanted to go to, and I didn't get in. And I was devastated. And all of the counselors at my school couldn't believe it. They contacted the university and said, "Why didn't you accept this girl? She's a perfect candidate," and whatever, but they wouldn't do it. But I'm so grateful that they didn't, because I wouldn't be sitting here right now had I gone to that other university. Probably I'd be doing something else. But I'm really grateful that those people said, "Nah, so that I could be sitting here right now with you.
Aussi,
Yes, likely.
à bout de Trump, en Musk, en etc., Louis XVI, as it is basic decency that is missed, or
A basic what?
decency.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no, it's so clear that we wouldn't behave in that way if we saw the basic essence of who we truly are and the basic meaning and the basic, is that what you meant?
Décence, I mean. La décence.
Decency.
Ah, decency, yes.
Yeah.
Same thing. Yeah, same thing, absolutely. Because what is decency? It's being acting from a place of things as they truly are. That's what integrity is as well. Yeah, definitely. And I'm not, this is not judgmental when I say that. Just
No, no,
listen.
no, 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 no. But when you recognize truly your basic nature and even in your relative limits in the relative world, you find basic decency. It's something important, I think, in the practice too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That's where, the relative and the absolute are one. That there is no way for us to experience the absolute outside of the relative, outside of this life, this body, this vessel, these interactions, interhuman reactions, love, all of that. That's the only way that we can experience the absolute. If we didn't have, the relative doesn't exist without the absolute and vice versa. So yes, that's true, yeah. I think Freddie, you were man of the way. You were trying to say something.
Yes, it's about gratitude. It's so difficult to feel gratitude when someone stomp on your feet. And someone step on your feet, and I have the feeling that a lot of us, we feel like that. Someone just step on our feet, and we have difficulty to feel gratitude about that. Like you feel gratitude about your cold or about your example. It's so difficult.
Yeah, it is. Well, and we confuse, we think that, oh, we're supposed to love the fact that someone stepped on our feet, or that someone abused us, or that someone failed to acknowledge us, or, someone who insulted us or robbed our apartment, like happened to Debbie. That's not what, when we say be grateful for it, that's not it, it's then be grateful for what then that brings me in my life. It brings me to an awareness, maybe it can, of the other's motivation. Why did someone step on my feet? Why did someone rob my apartment? What, it's clearly they feel they're lacking something if they have to enter someone else's home and steal their computer. Clearly, they don't see their own worth if they're not acknowledging your worth. And then we can have some compassion, not because we like it, or that we've even, we can still be angry and upset about it, and hurt. But we cannot go their route. Like Michelle Obama used to say, when they go low, we go high. Which, okay, there's something to that, but that's still really making a difference. It's still condemning the lowness and thinking that there's something higher. Can we see that we also have greed? We also would like to have something that's not ours. We also sometimes step on people's feet. We don't acknowledge people sometimes. Sometimes we're not even aware of it.
Makes think Debbie, you want to no, it's just it makes me think of something in observing that I've been observing for a long time now, but that came up, and what Miguel says about the patterns coming back and mindfulness and seeing it, and it's not because you see it that it stops necessarily, but you relate to it differently, and what just Freddie said, just stepping on someone's feet, or being stepped on your own feet. It's and finally something that you talked about in a talk some not that long ago about someone passing, blocking in the not at the elevator, but on the someone was in your way and you asked the person to move and the person sort of wasn't happy about it. Anyway, I bike every day, and every day I have people barking at me because I do this or I don't do that, and I'm always unhappy. And I see myself in that pattern of answering, and the anger that comes out of me because it's like feeling unjustly treated. And yeah, so it's just something that it's a beautiful practice actually to see it and see and so you see the reaction and see what it brings up in you and the other and yeah and how can you be grateful? How am I grateful for this? And stop the reaction or lessen the reaction and just see have compassion for what the person is experiencing because if I trigger that in that person it's probably something behind it. And sometimes I'm not behaving as a perfect biker, that's also true, but anyway, it's fascinating and it's nothing at the same time. It's so unimportant in a way in when you put it in all the vastness of what's happening and horrifying stuff and much more difficult situations in my life and other people's lives. It's just one small thing, but I really pay attention to it. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for sharing.
Yeah, thank you. Because it's not any greater or less or than any other incident or occasion in life. Like my Mizumi Roshi, everything is important. Everything. Debbie.
Yeah, I can't see all of you at the same time. I don't want to step on anybody's feet talking. But as the most bumped into person in the Gare du Nord, I'm very glad that we brought this up because, as Joa told me several years ago, the Gare du Nord is Dharma. And being bumped into is a real lesson. I'm probably the smallest person in the Gare du Nord, too. And one thing that has really helped me in not punching somebody bigger than me is to little by little realize that most of the people that bump into me are not doing it on purpose, which I thought for a long time they picked me. And they're probably not even, they don't even have a purpose. They're just trying to get through the hall to their train. So all the bumping into is just, it's like the collision of junk in space or something. It's not about me. It's about there are too many people in the gathering. Oh, and consequently, now I stumble when we get as far as Trump. I must admit, he's kind of every time Amy Roshi says, like Donald Trump, I think, well, except for Donald Trump. But in most cases, it's really a metaphor for human behavior for me. Most people that are messing with me or mistreating other people in front of me, it's not, they're not doing it on purpose, but it's like the Gare du Nord. They're just trying to get somewhere. And they're bashing things that are in their way. Now, this is it's not an excuse, but it makes, for me, it has made things so much easier not to be trying to figure out why they're doing this to me, which was a, it took about 10 years to get past that obstacle. And thank you, Freddie, for this subject, this topic. It's something I know something about.
Yeah, thank you. I know that this is something Debbie has talked about, and I know the story of Joa telling you that. And just for those of you who aren't Parisian, the Gare du Nord is a major train station in Paris, and it's one of the, I think it is the biggest, most frequented train station in Europe, or one of the most frequented. So it's huge. Has lots of commuter lines and subway lines and lines going to the north of Europe and to Germany, and it's huge. And we all feel small in it. Joa.
Yeah, hi everyone. Sorry for being late. Just this comment from Freddie, and then the discussion that followed about stepping on someone else's feet, or brings me. I'm not quite sure what to make out of it, but early on today, I saw a report on Gaza, and the people from Gaza, the Palestinians, were saying about the treaty, oh, that means we won. And I was quite astounded that they thought they had won, the Palestinians had won that war. when this just the land is totally destroyed. And that comment on stepping on when someone steps on your feet, it seems that I'm trying to see how it connects with the practice, but it seems that it tends to reinforce so much who we are or who we think we are. It's like our identity. It's like our identity is whether we're on a bike or someone is bombing us. It's like they're trying to destroy us, and the reaction is like the self just kind of solidifies, and we want to survive. And how do we? And however, and at the same time, in order to make peace, they need to kind of drop these identities. So there's a, yeah, I'm not sure how to make out of that, but just like this, yeah, this reinforcement of the self when feeling threatened. It seems like a very reactive and essential, and yeah, an essential, very useful for our own existence. And actually, when we're driving and when we're bicycling and someone does something dangerous that puts us in danger, our reaction is like actually anger, like they're threatening my own life. Yeah. But at the same time, that so this is when reactivity is essential, and when reactivity is becoming not beneficial is yeah, when it starts to yeah, we kind of think we all know when it becomes not unbeneficial. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Well, and if we have to stop here in a minute, but if we, there's a difference between, as you say, responding to a situation because we may be harmed, and responding to it, living your life like, the tech bros, living your life to impress other men, alpha men. The alpha male of the moment, and not protecting women and the vulnerable and others. That's very different than responding to a situation when we're being, in a situation where we might be harmed. Whether it's, riding a bike or launching war. It's crazy that the ceasefire is supposed to take effect on Sunday, and Israel today just like bombarded the shit out of some place in Gaza, and 70 people died. So it's come, the ceasefire is coming, but let's like get all this stuff out there before it happens. It's crazy, but that's our world. So what do we do? I feel like our response of this practice is really, the most beautiful, positive thing we could be doing in our world today. Sitting down and waking up. So thank you for being here. We're out of time. Thank you.